Is this radio going to be in a cabin, or is it just going to be underneath it like a T-top?
Relevant question yet. It's a little half in between. The boat's got a windshield, a roof. It has canvas sides that I have never used, so the weather comes in, but not completely. The windshields kick out. So sometimes you get a little water inside. So it's not an outside environment, but it's a marine environment.
Okay, can I suggest that you make a short pigtail, seal it up well against the radio, and then just assemble and disassemble the end of the pigtail to the antenna connector on the boat every time you're bringing the radio in and out?
Interesting idea. I had not considered. I was trying to avoid as many connections as I want to eliminate failure points, but you make a very good point. If I control the failure point, I can chop it out and replace it as necessary. That's an interesting thought.
Worked for me on my sailboat for 9 years.
What was the brake connection that you used? Was that something different than an SL2 during the IPL-259?
I used ends only because they're water, resistant in and of themselves. I sealed up the SO239 PL259 on the back of the radio, and I used the end connectors on the pigtail.
Wow, that's a great idea. That just changed my whole game plan. That's a terrific, terrific, well thought out idea. Thank you.
Okay, and one way do I clear?
Okay, Jim, are we done on this particular question?
I'm satisfied. That was an ingenious idea, but feel free to continue or not as you see fit. But I'm satisfied with the discussion. Thank you all.
Okay, very good, Jim. Thank you, as always, for participating. I want to give Wesley a chance. He's third on the list. So thanks, Jim. Thanks, everyone, who answered Jim's question. And Wesley, what do you got for us tonight?
Okay. I'm going to try to go quickly through all of it. Because you mentioned 180 degrees out of phase, just a quick comment, I didn't respond for it. The differential mode drags one wire positive while the other is driven negative. That's 180 degrees out of phase. And the Comet mode implies that some same signal component appears on both with respect to local reference ground. There's a solar activity monitor that is being sold by Merrill Lynch. And this is good because they take their guesswork out of HF operation. You see the solar activity of the band. So it's a real-time solar data, instant visibility in the shock, improve operational efficiency, compact and easy to use, ideal for age of operator I'm reading right now. And if somebody wants to know more about it, the title of the video is This Shock Tool Shows When Bands Are Open. Now the second one is some information about ham radio, so let me drop first. Okay, talking about year 2027 and the International Space Station, crew members contact with ham radio operators. Right now, they are looking for volunteers who wants to have a 10 minutes
in conversation with space station, and you need to send your proposal, and application must be submitted to arisusa.org website by May 22nd. And second information is ITU Corporation has purchased 15-acre unused National Guard armory site in Indiana, because they want to have a production again for high gain and Kushcraft antennas that were acquired from MFJ that is no longer there. So ITU wants to do it. Now, the third information is there was a guy who was using a CB radio to threat other guys, and he was 61 years old man, and he was arrested for that. As far as other things, another email is searching for satellite signals from Iran. Let me drop. Okay. There is a ham radio operator who is famous. We've been one of the guy. He is concentrated on satellites and ham radio operation, but also amateur operation on satellites. Now, in his video that is titled Searching for Satellite Signals from Iran, if I remember correctly, I can open up that one. Hold on. He's searching for satellite signals from Iran, right? He shows that U.S. has ability to take over Iranian satellites, and video presents creator point of view about Russian technology, quality, and performance in area of satellites. Interesting. So for ham radio operators, you can view it. The name of the channel is Save It for Parts. Save It for Parts. One word. Save It for Parts. Now, another news is May 17, 2026. In Dayton, we have Hamvention. Right. And for those who wants to go there, I remember that a group of ham radio operators from New York was for years going there, and then they were talking to R&W about their experience over there and how was the drive. Now, let me drop. Okay. Subject for Dr. Roy. The title of the email was Manual Dexterity and Brain Evolution Across Entire Primate Lineage and What If. So the question is, if there was no extinction, what was the chance for dinosaur becoming like a human? Dr. Roy, N2G.
Hey, C2GS, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of a silly question. It has no real ultimate answer. Almost everything that affected the Earth globally had an effect on evolution. Is there any particular intrinsic reason why dinosaurs should become very like human beings? It's kind of a flaw in thinking about what evolution is. Evolution is simply a selective selection of traits to optimize your genes going forward into the future. So if every living thing needed to be a human-like creature in order to survive, then I guess everything would be human, but that's not the case. You know, there's nothing special about us, I'm sorry to say, except that we have very complicated thought capability. Our brain grew large enough where we developed consciousness and skill sets and all kinds of things. But it's kind of meaningless to say, you know, if the dinosaurs weren't disrupted, would they be humanoid? Maybe, possibly not. You know, they did survive, the smaller ones, and they ended up all being birds, and birds don't really look too much like humans.
KD2FYU.
Yes, George.
Thank you, Roy. That's exactly what I was going to say, because that's what I've learned all my life, that the dinosaurs evolved into what is chirping around us.
Yeah, yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about, you know? I mean, who would have thunk that some of those fossils had feathers covering them?
Well, they had learned to fly because of the environment that was being destroyed around them.
Well, I mean, they were flying reptiles closely related to dinosaurs before the meteorite struck.
And it is interesting that when I look at birds and I see them, and I could just see the fact that they have this actual evolution that was from whatever science has given us in dinosaur evolution is something that would understandably, over the years, and I've read about this for 60 years, and you could just see it, how it happened.
Yeah, well, I mean, thankfully, we've both been exposed to a lot of information, the fossils. I'm sure you went to the Museum of Natural History, as I did. Lots of books, lots of pretty pictures, and so thankfully, you know, we sit on the shoulders of giants when we kind of understand evolution.
But they decided to do something that we cannot.
Yeah, that's quite true. They took a little turn in the evolutionary trend that suited them very well because their kind spread all over the world. So it was an effective adaptation.
They can fly, but we need machines to fly. Thank you for bringing me in. Bye.
You're welcome, George. Back to you, Wes.
Okay. So the first mammals were not dinosaurs. They are distinct evolutionary lineages that diverge from common ancestors approximately 210 to 225 million years ago, long time before dinosaurs appeared. And now the question is, were rats our ancestors? Back to you.
No, our rats are not our... rats are not our ancestors. We're distant cousins. We're both mammals. The mammal that had primates and rats in common were very far back in the evolutionary chain, far, far, far away from present-day rats.
Based on what I have is my mammals belong to the synapsid lineage, which evolved from mammal-like reptiles called therapsids and synodonts. And based on information gathered, and also from AI, rats are the closest of our ancestors, if any. Now, of course, we may ask a question, a book and AI, or book versus AI, what's the difference? Who gives you a steady, repeatable data and information? AI gives you changed one based on many, multiple causes, and could be altered and maneuvered. But anyhow, thank you very much for that. We have another one, parasites. So we had four long time ago. And can we say that our brain is what we see today thanks to parasites? Because then eventually women that had less hair were more attractive, and then we have a human being dead, lost the hair, and then he had to find out how to sew the clothing. And that was the mechanism of leading to today's animal known as human being. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Well, again, it's not that simple. It's not that A led to B. It's that all these things screwed around with all kinds of things, and in the end, there's us here. If there was no such thing as parasites, would we be hairy creatures? I don't know. Maybe. Maybe not. You can't definitively say. Parasites have affected evolution tremendously, more importantly than whether we have hair or not. There are some scientists who conjecture that it's because of parasites that sexual reproduction was the most popular method over asexual reproduction, so that there would be opportunity for more mutation and more shuffling of the genetics to get out from under some parasite that had evolved to work in our body, but not a lot of other bodies. So, you know, it's all conjecture. No one has a time machine, and no one can prove any of these comments.
82 VHD.
Yes, Jim.
Since we're discussing Darwin and such, I want to bring up something that's never brought up in conversation. If you've ever read The Origin of the Species, which is the book that Darwin wrote that all this is all based on, you have to have seen chapter 6, which is difficulties of the theory. And he lays out, this may not all work. This may just be a guess. In fact, it is a guess. Nobody ever talks about it, but it's in the book. I got to pass that along. Back to that.
The book is a very important, interesting thing, but this is not like the Bible. I don't really care what he had to say. Evolution is a study that is advancing and progressing to this very day and will continue to. His book was very important in kind of kicking things off, but there is an enormous amount of information discerned from the time of publishing that book. That book is not like a Bible where you have to go back to it. No one has to go back to it. You could be proven completely wrong. And science often kind of goes down rabbit holes and changes their minds about things. So again, what I'm discussing is the fundamental present day theory of evolution, not Darwinism. No professional biologist studies Darwinism. Darwinism is what people who believe in creationism call evolution, so that they can go back to a dusty old book and say, "See here, we're scientists. We go forward. We don't go backward."
Denisovian man.
In what way would you like him explained?
That's a good question. My point is, there's way too many suppositions on this topic that get taken as fact when they're just great big guesses.
There are incredible amounts of fossils documenting a lot of phases of development of Homo sapien. To say it's just an idea, just a theory someone's rolling around with, is not an accurate assessment. Denisovian man is a variant hominid in the same way as a Cro-Magnon is to Neanderthal and such. There have been small branch groups that have died out over years. Not only did they didn't just die out, but modern genetic research demonstrates that there are human beings to this day with Denisovian and Neanderthal gene sequences. Apparently, our ancestors had sex with that group of hominids, and their genes continue in our body. This is very common in Europe and in European Americans with European heritage. The only group that has a significantly smaller amount of those hominid genes are Africans, because apparently there wasn't that much of an opportunity to breed in Africa with them. They moved on and evolved in Europe and in some aspects of Asia, and I think Australia as well. But we know a lot about them. We know their gene sequences. We know that we have some of their gene sequences. So this is not conjecture or guesstimating.
Held assumptions that aren't as solid anymore. They're shifting timelines and genetics and subspecies, and there was a lot of things that they wanted to say were, you know, they weren't theory, they were fact. No, they were theory, and the theory ain't holding up.
Well, like I said, it's a science. It's not perfect. It's always evolving. But pretty much all of the things we find are self-consistent and they make sense. We found bones that were not Homo sapien, and they have done genetic research into those bones, and they have found variations that are consistent with an offshoot of a pre-species that evolved into us. So again, there's nothing that just kind of says that this doesn't make sense. There's no contradictions. So I don't know what you're assessing. I mean, if you go back in history to 150 or 200 years ago, when occasionally people would make facsimiles of artifacts that didn't really exist to get money and such, and then they were proven not to be legitimate. Yeah, but that happens with everything. So there's no smoking gun. Evolution is the best theory available. It explains a great deal about everything that we have found. And, you know, if you want to disprove it, go off, do a study, research it, publish it, and discount it. The only people who discount 99.9% of anything that evolutionary studies propound are creationist hack organizations that are simply being paid off to make stuff up. So I don't see the doubt that you see, but you're free to have it.
Well, I won't hijack the venue, but no, I think the lens and the direction of looking at things is changing. A lot of the things that we've taken as facts for the last decades or so, it's like, well, maybe that was a little grandiose for you to think so much of that. That's my feeling. Anyway, I won't drag this off in a different direction. Back to the megahertz.
Okay, back to you, Wesley, but wrap it up soon. We're running out of time.
Germany and Switzerland. Human level is not a universal case of Switzerland-Germany bridge problem. So Germany and Switzerland jointly built a bridge across the Rhine River between Laufenburg, Germany, and Laufenburg, Switzerland, which was completed in 2003. The project and engineering error were two halves did not initially meet due to sign error in height of calculation. So the difference was 54 centimeters. And when we're talking about the error was the sea level, because both of them, they took sea level as a base for calculation. And knowing Germans and knowing Swiss, they're the best in mechanics. They're best engineers. be assumed like the best manufacturers, the best machinery, and whatsoever. Dr. Roy, for your comment.
Even smart people make stupid mistakes. You know, every so often you'll hear of NASA programming something wrong and it going completely wacky. So although smart people usually get it right, sometimes they get it wrong.
Okay, so we were talking about sea level. And the title of the email is Sea Level is Not a Universal Case of Switzerland and Germany, Bridge Problem. So the two countries use different vertical datums. German use Normann Null based on North Sea, while Switzerland use reference based on Mediterranean Sea. And the error, we're talking about the earlier error, the sea level differs by 27 centimeters, and the engineers intended to rise the Swiss side by the amount, by that amount to align with the German side. So then, was, let's say, two countries were building half of the bridge and they were trying to meet together. However, document error recorded this as a minus 27 centimeters adjustment, effectively doubling the discrepancy. So that was 54 centimeters, 27 centimeters different plus 27 error, it came to 54 centimeters, yeah. Dr. Roy, for your comment, and I'm going to the last one.
I don't have any comment. Wesley, could we possibly do that next Sunday? Because it's already 10:32.
It's short. It's a mushroom. Mushroom and the rain. Can mushroom create the rain? Back to you.
Well, can it create the rain? Not particularly. Can it scatter fine material from spores and such? And can they act as points of condensation to cause rain in the same way that silver nitrate crystals are kind of flung out of airplanes and they're the seeding material for small droplets that start rain falling from clouds? Yeah.
Yeah, based on what I found is, I didn't know about it. I was just kind of surprised what the mushrooms have to the rain. So millions of tons of fungal spores are dispersed in the atmosphere every year, and those living cells, along with plant spores and pollen grains, may act as a nuclei for condensation of water in clouds, and that's how they help to create the rain. Thank you very much, and that's all for tonight.
Okie dokie. Thank you, Wesley. Thank you for your participation. And I hope everyone enjoyed this segment. And we'll come back next week when we try and do this all over again. But it's way time for Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
Hey, very good. ACTGS WS2N SpaceNet Report with Weimark. And, I could have an abbreviated net. No problem. We usually go to around 11 o'clock here. And I just wanted to bring up the story about the Hubble Space Telescope. You know, that thing is still in orbit, launched in 1990. And it's still operating, still getting very good science back from it. But, you know, there's thousands of other satellites up there, including a couple of satellites by this company, Vantor. They come out of Colorado. And Vantor, they have these cameras on board, you know, really sophisticated cameras. And one of their satellites, last Friday, came very near to the Hubble Space Telescope. And it wound up being about 35 miles away, and they have these cameras that zoomed in, and they actually took a picture of the Hubble and flying there, you know, it's 330 some odd miles above the surface. You know, give you an idea, it's around 50 so miles higher than the International Space Station. So, you know, the satellite sent this picture back, and it's a beautiful picture of the Hubble still in space. You know, you can see the solar wings, you can see the aperture, you know, the whole body of the Hubble. So anyway, I took the I got the picture and sent it over to Roy's website. He's got, you know, if you go to roy.ac2.com, you know, he's got all his material. You know, he puts that up every week. But you know, if I have a space topic, I'll put that up as well, so you can just what the Hubble actually looks like today, all these years later. This WS1.
SDP. Hey, Paul, how you doing? I saw that picture. It's absolutely amazing. They must have some amazing cameras, obviously. 35 miles away, it's crystal clear. But quick question, do you know if this space shuttle ever... is it on a similar orbit than them? Do they ever come within 50 miles of it and see it from once time to time, or are they on orbits that just don't cross paths?
Yeah, the it is around 250 miles up. This thing was around 375 to 400, and I think now it seems to be a little lower. I think it's around 350, 345, something like that. But yeah, it's much higher than the space station in Britain as well. I think Hubble is 40 something degrees, and where the space station is around 51.6.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, I didn't. My math was bad, but it just made me think. I wonder why we never seen a picture like that from the space station. All right. Thank you.
Did you get a picture on the internet, or did you go?
I saw Roy's. I check Roy's site every week. He has some great links on there every week.
Yeah, he really does. Okay. Very good. All right, another topic I wanted to cover is the New Glenn rocket that launched last week. And their goal was to put our AST communication satellite into orbit. The first stage, Mark Bray, you know, the plan for New Glenn is to have these reusable rockets similar to what SpaceX is doing with their Falcon 9s, but New Glenn is like four times bigger. It's like the heavy lift vehicle. SpaceX ever got their act together with the Starship and was able to bring their vehicle back, I mean, that Starship is competing with so New Glenn has launched three times successfully. The first time the booster just didn't make it back to the Jacqueline drone ship, but that flight, but they did make it to orbit. The second flight, they were able to have the booster land successfully on the drone ship, and the payload was two spacecraft escapades. One's called Blue and the other one's Golden. They're right now hanging out about a million miles away from Earth. And in the near future, they'll be flying off to orbit Mars. But this time, they have a second stage, large second stage on New Glenn. It consists of not one, but two BE-3 engines. BE-3 engine is a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine. If you ever watch the suborbital flights that New Glenn does with New Shepard, one of these engines on that spacecraft is able to launch six people into suborbital space. They go up around 100 kilometers, and then they come back down and land with parachutes. Those engines, they're very happy with them. They decided, well, let's take two of them and put them on the second stage of the New Glenn. And New Glenn has seven big engines for the first stage, that will be four engines. And they run by liquid methane, liquid oxygen. Actually, it's natural gas, liquid natural gas, LNG, but it's more or less methane. That's a very big booster. The second stage, two of these B-3 engines, same engines that they do the suborbital flights with. And, collectively, it makes it a very big rocket. It's 320 feet high. I mean, it's only a couple of feet different than the SLS that NASA built that just recently sent four astronauts to the moon and back. But imagine, if you watch that rocket take off, the SLS, imagine that thing being reusable. Well, that's pretty much what New Glenn is. They plan on doing reflights of any of their boosters around 25 times before they retire them. And even at that point, they'll probably go beyond that. The second stage, which consisted of two of these B-3 engines, they pushed the satellite this time, where they thought it was going to make it to orbit, but it wound up falling short for a number of reasons. They did not get to the altitude or the inclination that they needed to do for that satellite. So, to make a long story short, that satellite winds up will deorbit and burn up in the atmosphere. But the problem was the engine, the second stage with these two engines was also temporarily in orbit. That stage did not get to the proper orbit that they needed to go around. They wanted to go around 350 to 400 miles. They stayed very low, only maybe 140 miles above the surface. By being there, which actually was a good thing, because the reason it didn't make it is they had a problem with one of their rockets on that second stage. So the thought, of course, goes through their mind, oh no, this is going to be stuck in orbit. This is a monster vehicle. It's like similar to like Skylab from years ago. I mean, it's a diameter of 23 feet. It's 80 feet long. It's like an eight-story building. And weighs countless tons. I looked up, it was net weight was around 25 tons. But, let's say it was completely fueled, it's like 10 times that amount. It's like, 250 tons. So a lot of fuel, I'm sure, was gone. But if you compare the weight of what was still available inside this vehicle, this second stage, you compare the weight to Skylab, it was very similar. So, back in the 70s, when the Skylab was going to deorbit, it was a big worry, I think. It deorbited in 79. When they realized that the Skylab was going to crash into the Earth, it was like, I wonder where. And it turned over the Indian Ocean, but parts of it did crash onto Australia. But now they had a, you know, Blue Origin had temporarily had the same situation with this thing. They didn't know where it was going to deorbit. They couldn't refire the engines at a certain time to make it deorbit, you know, let's say over the South Pacific, like it's the graveyard. So wherever it come down, it's going to come down. And sure enough, it did eventually deorbit mostly over the water. But and the only reason for it was because it wasn't high enough. And the atmosphere had rarefied air up there, but enough to slow it down. And then, you know, within 24 hours, it did burn up in the atmosphere. But there are parts of it that make it down to the ground. You know, they have these tanks that are, you know, 10 feet long. And, if it hit land, it would have been a problem. So now, because of all of this, the FAA has now grounded New Glenn's future flights, which is very, very bad. But, hopefully, they'll be able to figure out exactly what went wrong. They'll eventually be able to report that to the FAA, and then they'll get themselves ungrounded. So they can get back to normal. I would like to see that happen because scheduled for this year, they're supposed to launch the first lander to the moon. It will be unmanned, but it's a large lander. It's twice as big as the yellow that we landed on the moon with half a dozen of those things from 69 into the early 70s. This thing's like twice as big, and this is a cargo view. And eventually, there's going to be a bigger one, well, MK2, that will be a crewed vehicle. But you know, they need to prove their technology. They need to prove the new engine that's on that land. They call it the E7 engine, and they need to. And that, by the way, it's going to be a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine. They need to show that they can pinpoint land this large cargo vehicle onto the moon, onto the south pole of the moon. And they plan on doing that this year. So hopefully this thing is not delayed where, you know, that gets pushed back in time. And they're competing with SpaceX, who's going to have the first lander. SpaceX or Blue Origin. So we'll see. Right now, my money is with Blue Origin. I think they still have a shot. I think they'll figure out what went wrong with the upper stage on this last flight. And by the way, they plan on launching again, and they will. Alliance, an extremely reliable vehicle, and this time they'll be launching satellites, communication satellites for Amazon. They are now called LEO satellites by Amazon. They were called Kuiper satellites. They changed their name. They have, I think, around 240 of them up there now. They need to eventually get minimum of 1,500 up, within the next year or so, to stay in good grade with the government. That's what their contract was for. So we'll see how that goes. They plan on launching 29 of these broadband satellites. They stacked them all up on this one vehicle, and Atlas V is running the 551 version, 551 5 stands for the diameter of the fairing, where all the satellites are located, and 5 stands for 5 meters in diameter. And then the second 5, and the 551, is the amount of boosters that they have attached to the Atlas. Atlas runs two engines, originally built by Russia. They're using up a bunch of engines that they still have in storage. So they're called the RSL-180s. They are supplemented by these massive boosters built by Northrop Grumman. And I'm going to have 5 of them. They can run the Atlas without boosters. They can run them with 1. They've done it with 1. They can put it all the way up to 5. It'll be their heaviest version. And we'll go off tomorrow at 8:52 at night. And then tomorrow night in Long Island, it's going to be very clear here. So if you go out about 5 minutes after launch, you should be able to, and you'll see the east, you should be able to still see the rocket engines still firing from the second stage of the Atlas. And you might see the end of the first stage, and the second stage kicking in. Second stage is a Centaur rocket. Second stage is liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And it should be interesting. I plan on doing that. You know, weather's supposed to be good, not, you know, no wind. It's supposed to be a clear night. And we'll see if that's doable. And hopefully they get their 29 broadband satellites into orbit to join the couple hundred that they already have there. Any comments? Trying to leave enough time with people on Echo Link. Anyway, another launch on the 28th, a couple of days from now. That's probably Tuesday. And that one's launching from Europe. We won't be able to see this one, but it's another launch of Amazon satellites to join the one that's going to go up tomorrow. And European Space Agency is being paid by Amazon to launch these broadband satellites as well. This one is 32, and the reason for that is it's being launched by the Ariane 6 rocket from French Guiana in Kourou, French Guiana down in South America. So this Ariane 6 is a heavy lift vehicle, and they put boosters on there as well. By the way, everything involved with that rocket is liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. The Ariane 5 was the original one. They launched around 80 flights during their history. But that's been retired for the Ariane 6, which has a lot more thrust. They found ways to make it more affordable to build. Ariane 6 is not a reusable rocket, so you know, a lot of competition with all these companies like SpaceX and now Blue Origin, and eventually a couple of the other ones. Relativity is going to have reusability. Another company called Stoke, they should launch within the end of the year or maybe the beginning of next year. That they plan on being reusable. But Ariane 6, they didn't build it that way. But it is a large rocket. To give you an idea, they're launching 32 things compared to the 29 that Atlas tomorrow will be launching. So, anyway, hopefully over time you'll be able to get there eventually 3,000 200 satellites they need for a complete operation. But I think they could start operating at around 1,500. And the reason they need to have this all done by a certain time, I think I mentioned this last, the government contracted with them because, you know, the timeline, because they need the spectrum space, you know, all these different bands that these satellites work on, then they're allowed to, you know, say, okay, we're going to use this, nobody else can use it, and then have delay for, you know, year after year after year, and then all this would be going unused for all those years that they're not allowed to, you know, stockpile the spectrum. So they make a contract with the government. Okay, you could have that, you know, these bands, frequencies, but, you know, to do it, you have to be up and operating by a certain time. And they did that. And I don't think they're gonna make it. So I think they're gonna have to request and extend their use of those frequencies until they get more of the satellites up into space. Any comments? Just covered this one topic about Voyager. You know, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 launched back in 1977, still on the way to God knows where, way outside of the solar system now, at least three times the distance of Pluto. Voyager 1, NASA has shut down another one of their... I think when they took off, they had like 10 different instruments on board, you know, for different purposes. And as the years, decades go by, they eventually shut different ones down. I think
that time
three.
Complete.
And the reason for it is, you know, they use up electricity. And there's only a certain amount of electricity that's being produced on the two voyages. And they're being... created by RTGs, radioisotope thermoelectric generators, and they have these plutonium in there, plutonium 238, and the half-life of those things, I think, is like 85 years or something. So every year they lose a percentage, roughly around four watts per year. They loses the capability. And all the decades have gone by, they're down there, they're getting pretty low. They want to be able to still communicate, and there's a couple of other science instruments that are left. So they shut this thing down. This one's called the low energy charge particle experiment. And they believe in the future, maybe a month or two, they might be able to click it back on. But for now, they're shutting it down. And we'll see what happens in the future. These things are still running. Both of them, Voyager 1 and 1-2, 1 and 2 are doing good. Like Voyager 1, though, I mean, it's so far away. Like, when they sent commands for this thing to shut it down, it took almost just short of 24 hours before the signal gets to the vehicle. You know, that's traveling the speed of light. And another 24 hours before JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, gets an answer, you know, whether or not whatever move that they... we're doing, in this case, shutting something down, was successful or not. They'll send data back and they'll know it's okay. So, we'll see how this does. And we always talk about Voyager. I know Dick came to our Voyager topics. So, we keep that up here on the net. So, So any other last comments before we close down? We usually shut down around 11 o'clock, you know, and then Limark tries to receive back to normal operation. Any other comments? Okay, nothing heard. By the way, a couple of weeks ago I saw that movie, Project Hail Mary. Anybody, if it's still playing in the movie theaters, it's really a cool movie. But now I'm going to turn it back to Roy. Tomorrow night is the Club in Bonnet on the same repeaters. Starts at 8:30, not 8 o'clock. Roy starts his net at 8 o'clock on Sundays, but all the other nets, nighttime nets are 8:30. And then that's always followed by Swap and Shop with George, KD2FIU, and then that's always followed by Radio Newsline. So for now, let me just turn it over to Roy. Thank everybody that participated and everybody that stood by and listened. AC2GS, WS2N, for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. Back.
This is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. I hope you had fun. I hope you learned a few things, and I hope you'll join us again. We'll be back next Sunday, 8 p.m., to do this all over again. As is our practice, let me remind you of some clever comments from some clever people. One, our own Dick K2RIW, who always used to end his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other. And I always like to bring up good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas, but not so wide open that your brains fall out, because you're going to need them one of these days. Anyway, everyone, have a great week. Stay safe. Be well. And if you can, possibly join us again next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we do this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I will be closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net after I say, Slava Ukraine.
Thank you, W1WOR. So thank you all, KE2AJL is clear. Have a good night, 73.